This week on Retronauts, check out my ceremonial bone pit on Insta. By the fetid breath of the dark twin Kazon, it is I, Nadia Oxford, of the Axe of the Blood God. Hi. Those of you with MyCon-grade memories will recall that we hosted a Retronauts episode not that long ago about Star Control and Star Control 2, and that was with my excellent friends, Siobhan Bott and Scott Sharkey. And wouldn't you know it, we are back to do more Star Control. We've picked up a couple of hitchhikers since our last excursion, two guys who call themselves, like, Fred and Paul or something like that. You seem like nice dudes. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves, starting with you, Fred.
I'm Fred Ford. I've worked for a long time with Paul Ritchie, and we made Star Control 2, the Urquan Masters.
And I'm Paul Ritchie, and I have no idea what this man is talking about. He just ran into the room and said, we've worked together for 35 years. Maybe it's my memory that's fading over time, but I'm Paul Ritchie, and I'm a game designer and ex-studio head and ex-Dungeons & Dragons fanatic. Actually, still current Dungeons & Dragons fanatic.
Okay, Sharky, Siobhan, I know you're itching to introduce yourselves again as well, so why don't we take a moment? Siobhan, you go first.
Hi, I'm Siobhan Butt. Normally, I host a podcast about Magic the Gathering called Casual Magic, but every now and again, Nadia and Parrish and friends shanghai me into taping a Retronauts episode. It's usually about my favorite video games of all time, of which Star Control is one. If you listen to the last 2 hours we did about this podcast, you know that I could have probably gone for like 12 more.
Yes.
I am unbelievably excited right now. One might even say the juice is boiling. I was going to use the Mycon one, but that's a little too gross. You know,
yeah,
my flesh grows turgid. Or turgid. And
my fibers are turgid. Very
so
turgid.
So you used it anyway. Yeah.
Look, you know, I haven't played this game for 30 years not to use references every chance I get. Yeah, I'm stoked beyond words to be here. So let's go.
All right, Sharky, what about you?
Oh, yeah, Scott Sharky, freelance bastard. I've been basically in hiding for 10 years, so I don't really have anything going on.
Well, you've always been my friend, so that's worth something on the resume, I suppose.
Oh, shucks. But this is probably the first time you're ever actually going to see me starstruck. Like, I'm a huge, huge fan for, like, a lot of old Commodore games. Like, I cut my teeth on, like, Archon and Mail Order Monsters and shit.
So that's great.
Yeah. Like, that was just my jam. I had a disc just full of little critters, and yeah. I mean, like, I'm meeting the R3, so.
One of the R's, certainly, but yes.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know anybody knows, like, a mail order monsters, that was the AI that you fought all the time because you didn't have any friends. So.
I have to say, just for a fun aside, near my house, there's a gas station, and this is where I go to fill up my bike tire since I don't really drive. And there is a sign on the air pump that says, air is not free. And indeed, it costs about $2 to turn it on. And I just want you guys to know, I think of you and the Druids every time I see that sign.
And send us a photo.
I absolutely will. Like, if they still have the sign on there, like, the kid didn't peel it off. I mean, it is crazy that I paid $2. Like, when I was a kid, we'd bike down to the gas station and just F around with the bike pump for a couple hours. You know, that's what we had to do in the 80s before we all had Nintendos. It was living in the moment, not a cell phone anywhere.
We should just get a Crimson Corporation sticker and stick it on that machine there.
I think if you give them pedestrians, they'll give it to you for free.
Feed the furnace. No,
when you pay at the pump, they come out and start, like, throwing kids in your gas tank.
Just a second.
Maybe dinosaurs, maybe, but yeah.
Aww. I try not to think of oil
the drudge,
as dinosaurs.
With the dude just hanging there by his arms is still one of my favorite arts in the game. Because
yes.
The conversation's so casual, and yet this man is just, like, dangling, and it's gotta hurt. And he's just like, yeah, well, you know.
Why was the man dangling? Was there a specific reason? I don't recall.
Chairs are expensive.
Because he's an Amazon manager.
You know, just George Barr was the artist who did that illustration and that painting, and he had a lot of freedom to decide how best to represent the characters. So I would sit down with him for way longer than he probably wanted to and tell him about the character. And then he just thought that there was an unease and a tension. By being held by chains suspended from the ceiling. Like, what's going to happen? What's underneath him? Why doesn't he have a chair? So I think he made some really great choices as an artist to do that.
Man. He absolutely did. Like, one thing I want to get to is how a really interesting thing to me about Star Control, the more I think about it, Star Control 2, is how you guys really delve into the horror aspect of it's so Lovecraftian and yet so its own thing. Like, some of the, even the way the Arilu talk to the humans so subtly, like hinting, what is it they say? Like, there's no more Androsynth, only Ors now. Stuff like that is just, and you have so many flavors of the horror as well. Like, who are the Umga, like, they're trolls. They're funny. They're hilarious.
Yeah. And they're body horror monsters.
They're horrifying. They're
because they're also like 4chan trolls.
They are 4chan trolled on a galactic Lovecraftian level, and that is terrifying. Like, did you intend for there to be such an element of horror to the game? Because you really nailed it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, horror is one of the three main food groups for me. Are there only three food groups? Maybe there's four. But it's been living in my head. You know, I grew up when my parents told me I was going to be dead by the time I was an adult because of nuclear war. And then I read a lot of H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, a lot of early Stephen King. And so that just is one of the many sort of AIs running in my head, spitting out, you know, you're going to die. It's going to be horrible. Things are going to come from the shadows and devour your soul. But you can't do horror very long before it starts to lose, you know, cure. Terrifying mm-hmm. horror before it loses it, and you have to introduce something else. And for me, humor is always the only other place I can go, and it's really the flip side of horror to me. You don't usually laugh at unholy cosmic beings, but I think also just the idea that there's an alien race for humor involves eradicating species, you know, or just we relate to it, and you sort of think, gosh, they're funny, and then you realize, wait a minute, they're talking about dropping a meteor in the ocean. And like 4 mile high tidal waves, and that's not funny, but it kind of is.
It's funny when it happens to somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Homer Simpson, full of wisdom. He always said things like that. Yeah.
It's amazing because I normally hate horror. I'm very much not, like, it's not my jam in any way, shape, or form. But you're right. Like, every different alien race here is just another facet of terrifying. Like, first off, your first encounter with the Urquan is this big military bug demon that just coming here is like, you will die. There's that martial theme, and it's just horrifying. The first time you see the Kora and they're hanging over the pit of bones, it's like, what the hell? And all of these other races you run into, like the spiders, they're just spiders. They're giant demon spiders with the crazy font. Like, that's terrifying too.
With like a self-mutilation kink on top of that.
Yeah. Like, what? And I'm amazed now that I think about it. I'm like, I hate body horror. The Umga are amazing. What's going on? I don't understand. But it's so deftly interwoven that you don't even realize until, like, you start seeing the bubbles disappear on the star map, like when the various, like, the Kora start taking over, and you're like, oh crap, like, there's a scene where you run into the Utwig, and they're talking about their war with the Kora, and you're like, how's it going? And they're like, oh, well, you know, it was better. Times have been better. We lost millions of us, and we are just keep getting thrown into the green ones, and they keep blasting it back to the black ones, and we're dying. But, you know, it could be worse. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like, we just sent these people to genocide themselves so I could have another month of time in game. Like,
so
what?
I have another month.
Well, there's something powerful actually about hearing about something or reading about something rather than having it shown explicitly to you, because your own imagination can fill in the blanks then.
Sure. Yeah, I have to say, one of my favorite things about the horror element in this game is how Shiva mentioned the Kora and how cold and merciless they are, especially compared to the Tertsa, who are like, oh, we're going to put you in a slave shield and you're going to like it. Military music everywhere. The Kora are so direct and cold. And there is a line that always makes me shiver. Something about how across the millennia, like every, like millions of races have tried to get their wise men to calm us down. They have all failed. It's just, nothing says to me like you are going to die. Like there's no negotiation. There's nothing. Just you, hopefully, if you're lucky, ending up in the bone pit. And I can't remember who the voice actor was for that, for the Korob. They were absolutely incredible.
I believe it was the guy from Bananas at Large in San Rafael. So Bananas at Large was this music store that sold professional music equipment. And wow, we needed to get a DAT tape recorder. And I should look up his name because it's been a while. But he did the Korah. And who else did he do? He did Ilrath. I think he did the Ilrath. I could be wrong. You guys could check me up on this. But he was great. And he was just a salesman. Not just a salesman. He was a salesman at Bananas at Large in San Rafael. And when I heard his voice and he was talking about this digital audio tape recorder that he wanted me to buy, I'm like, wow, here's the deal. We need people to do voice acting. And he's like, I could do voice acting. Like, I thought so. So
it's like, hey, you know what you sound like? A sentient, terrifying centipede that's hanging over a pit of death.
He had range. He definitely had range.
But also, my father is a salesman, so I understand why he can like do the whole death spider, Lovecraftian horror voice. Like, my dad used to kind of imitate Dr. Claw for my amusement when I was a kid. But anyway,
that's terrifying. That's too.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, the bone pit was, again, the artists, you know, put that in there in the illustration. That was Errol Otis. And he,
of D&D fame.
Errol Otis of D&D fame. He wrote the Urquan theme. He wrote the music for the Urquan theme. He's a genius.
I didn't know he could do music. I've just known that I'm also a D&D hardcore. So like when you say Errol Otis, I just think of like the Monster Manual and stuff.
Oh hell yes.
Well, that's
yes.
Dave Sutherland, but you know what I'm talking about though.
Well, like, I went out there, he and I went to high school together. So,
what?
Yeah, I know it's crazy. He and I went to high school together. We put out a fantasy role-playing game book of our own and started a business when we were 17 called Booty and the Beasts and the Necromicon.
I saw the illustration for that. It looked really cool.
Oh, Errol was a genius in high school and has stayed that way all the way. But he's currently doing Hackmaster stuff, I'm sure you're aware, and he is my DM. Yeah. After a mere 45 years, he is still my DM. He painted that, and like so many of them, like the Mycon illustration, I would, you know, be thinking through the plot and I would understand the plot, and you know, it had been in my head for years at that point. So I knew the role of the Mycon, but when you get an illustration back, man, there was so much in there to pull from.
Yeah.
So I looked at the bone pit and I'm like, oh my, and, you know, and I knew what it was. And then I asked him a little bit about it. And then I'm like, yeah, this is a big deal. We're going to talk about this. And so you go back to the writing and you're like, we're going to add some whole bone pit things here. And you start realizing I'm making this statement here where he's referring to something horrific. The bone pit could fit here. You know, this is like cowbell. You need more bone pit. but seriously, that's one of the most exciting things about working with other talented people is the feedback thing that happens. You know, it's not like they're just filling a hole in your game. They're offering you something and it's always got more than you asked for. And, you know, then reaching in and seeing what's in there and connecting it back to your own work means that now when someone comes through, they'll actually think you intended it to be this way. And they'll think you were, you know, maybe a better writer than you actually are. So
the game is up, Paul.
Yeah.
Did you mention art? Did you have like traditional paintings done for all these characters, or were this just done in pixel?
Almost all of them were in paintings.
You mean so there's somewhere there's like an Urquan painting?
Except for the Urquan Xerzah, which was a digital painting I did in Deluxe Paint. But I think all of the other ones. So I can't remember. Fred and I have probably got like 8 or 9 of them. We bought him back from George. Errol refuses to sell his original. So he has the Ilrath, the Korah, you know, the Mycon, the Kunk. And they're beautiful paintings. So in his retirement, perhaps he will make those available.
I'm blown away because the idea that the idea that these aren't just like sprite
physical
drawings
objects.
Digitally is just like,
yeah,
it's like wrecking my mind right now. Like, that's
so
cool.
I have a couple
cool.
of them in my house. I'm in the toys. This is not the Toys for Bob. This is the Pistol Shrimp headquarters above Fred's garage. And Pistol Shrimp's a smaller, more intimate company. But at my place, which is a very small, intimate place as well, I've got, you know, Star Control artwork up. I've got the map from the Horde up. That is one of the most beautiful physical paintings of all time. By Ian McKeag, another person who worked on Star Control. At Star Control 2, the Urquhart Masters. We, by the way, you know, obviously, historically, those games were called Star Control at the time. Nowadays, the trademark doesn't belong to us, so nothing that we're doing from this time forward do we refer to as Star Control, because we can't. But it's the Urquhart Masters.
Well, with that in mind, is there any chance of you guys ever being able to tell the story that you implied in the first Urquhart Masters, where you're talking about, let's go and see the precursors and go to where the rainbow worlds are pointing, or anything like that?
Strange you should mention that. So for the past year or two, Fred and I have been working, both two of us as well as two other people, Ken Ford and Dan Gerstein. And we've all worked together at Toys for Bob over the years, and we're working on a sequel right now. And it does indeed cover what you're describing.
Ah, beauty.
Right now the story is funny, because back when we were doing the Urquhart Masters, Star Control 2, that story lived in my head for two and a half years. And Fred finally sort of picked me up and shook me by my feet and put it on a piece of paper. And now it's been more like 30.
Scrambled.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's been like 30 years that I've been thinking about this. And it's obviously the story's gone through some tremendous, there was a whole time when FWIFO had messed up time. And this is what's not going to happen. But I will tell you that this was in my head for a while, that FWIFO, after the end of the last game, you know, the main character was a hero and his friends, FWIFO, you know, Kalana.
FWIFO was a great character. FWIFO was the main character.
And he is me, by the way. And I sort of had this vision of FWIFO, like, going on late night talk show and doing, you know, product, you know, placements and making a ton of money. And then blowing it on something. I'm not sure what it was.
Football at the track.
Part of it was that he...
Listeners, my eyebrows have not dropped since I mentioned this.
I spent it all on Skylanders.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, and again, this is, you're hearing it first. So obviously, since 1990, when the story was invented, the full story, things have changed. Like the peace vault stuff, the little war in the Middle East, has come and gone and hasn't occurred. Things that are specifically mentioned in the plot, the timeline, you know, it hasn't happened as far as we know, you know. So one of my justifications for it was FWIFO and him goofing with time. The way to retcon is, well, you know, I had this couple of years and I think I may have taken drugs or actually traveled in time or both. And I'm so... Do you remember the whole thing about the peace vaults and how everybody put away their weapons in the, you know, early teens of the 21st century? And then you as the player were going to go, no, that absolutely didn't happen. He's like, yeah, I'm so sorry about that.
it's like how Star Trek has to keep pushing like back the eugenics wars or whatever. It's like the only reason this future is possible is just bootstrap assing around.
I think, I'm confident that everything we've seen about authoritarianism in the past, like 5-10 years, is the beginning of the eugenics war. Absolutely.
Oh,
although they're not demonstrating it visually. But anyway, moving on from a very negative topic to more positive. So a variety of stories have been kicking around in my head over these years. And the way that I work is I sort of build, happens, characters come alive in my head. And they talk to me, and I talk with them, and we have conversations. And that, I just document that conversation, essentially. So like FWIFO is just me talking about what I actually want in life. I want, you know, a big walled property with trees and rocks and the whole deal. So I've got all these characters running in my head. I can go talk with Thrinash. I can go talk with FWIFO. And it sounds kind of nutty, and it is potentially, you know, institutionalizable, if that's a word. But for me, I need to now share this with other people and get them out of my head.
I mean, that's how a lot of fantasy writers tend to, my other show is an interview show. And every time I talk to writers, they're always like, yeah, I listen to the story being told to me by these characters, and then I'm just transcribing it down. So I feel like that's not necessarily institutional as much as you're a writer. Get used to it.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I do the same thing. I have my characters talk to me and I kind of record that, and everybody suffers for it. But I wanted to say very briefly, while because you mentioned Toys for Bob, I found the reference to the oars in Skylanders, and I was just over the freaking moon. And I'm trying to, like, I'm like an ape telling these kids, I know that. Hoo, hoo. And they're like 10. They don't care. They're like, get out of here. You're scary. But yeah, I heard, I think it was Persephone was the fairy. And she's like, what did she say? Hello, extremely. And I'm just like, and I just felt really proud of myself for recognizing that.
There's a Spathy hat in Skylanders.
Is there a Spathy hat? Yeah. I did not find the Spathy hat. Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
It's so much fun to reach back. And even in the Horde, you can find Wimbley's trident. And it's a tremendously powerful weapon. It just was in the wrong universe. It was just sort of a useless piece of junk in the world of the Urquan Masters. But move it to the world of the Horde and Kirk Cameron, all of a sudden it gains awesome power. And man, we've picked some real winners in terms of people to participate. Oh man, can you imagine the horror we've seen of that guy? Oh, anyway, apologies for that.
Look, man, bananas, right?
Bananas at large.
Can I indulge in a fan question? Well, because I really want you guys to tell me how Star Control came to be, because I've never gotten to hear that story. But really, there's a question I've always wondered, and that is why? Why does Imelda Norme's bridge turn purple?
Oh,
Fred, I'll let you answer that one.
Oh, you can't trick us that easily. That's all I'll say.
Look, I've got 65,000 credits. I've been sitting here for 25 years. Please let me have this one. But, I mean, God, there's so many questions I want to ask you, because you're, like, literally my favorite game designer ever. Have you ever played Dragonlance or seen Dragonlance before?
Was that a Sega game?
No, it was a Dungeons & Dragons setting.
Oh, that one.
It's a module.
It was, while I was at TSR, it was being played as a game by the guy who became the head of the RPGA. I think Tom Mentzer was his name. Mm-hmm. Frank Mentzer. Can't remember if it's Tom. Tom or Frank. So that's what I know of it as. And he, like I said, I think before you got on, the dude wouldn't stop talking about dragons. And there's an appropriate amount to talk about dragons. And then there was how much he cared about them. And it was really people who are playing. I didn't play in his campaign, which in retrospect was a huge mistake. But so I know only about it what he told me in 1980.
Okay. Then never mind, because of the fact that the Punk are like exactly like the Kender race from there. But
dragon people are like horse girls. Like they just
absolutely.
I've got one track mind, and that track is a dragon. So what do you want me to do?
How many fern mushes were there in the 90s?
Oh, how many of them got pulled down because of copyright?
I have my only lingering claim to fame in Dungeons and Dragons was I invented the Thrycreen, which periodically they crop up. Yep. Periodically they crop up again, and people have of course breathed 1,000 times as much interest into them since I invented them than I did in my simple little description. But yeah.
They're super cool. So like I had a Thrycreen PC for a long time.
Oh really?
Don't ever ask a D&D player to tell you about their character. You should know better. But one of the things that I thought that Star Control did exceedingly well was that the storytelling you guys imbued in these characters and in this world building, like I had never played the original Star Control when I got to StarCon 2, but I still felt like I knew what had happened and that the events of that game impacted me while I was going through this game. Like it mattered to me. And for instance, the Androsynth. The Androsynth are obviously a major player in the first one. In the second one, you only see their shadows. And yet that, like, just those story segments of talking to the Oars, talking to the Heirloom, and learning, like, these people were here. They had their own freedom, their own planet, and now they're vaporized. And just the emotional resonance of feeling for people I've never seen or played or have any, like, connection to. And I'm just like, they will pay for what they've done to my beloved Androsynth. And like,
but they hated you.
Like when I was a kid and we'd be, you know, playing with my friends and stuff, I would be making up stories about the Androsynth and everything just because it was such a cool, like you did such a good job of developing a race that wasn't even there.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was terrified when you read about the Andersynth and the manual. It's like, oh my God, they hate us. They have justification for hating us. This is going to be a really hard fight when it gets to their territory. It gets to their territory. It's completely empty, like Siobhan said. And it's, again, that's that horror aspect. Like, where is this overly powerful race that's supposed to give me my due? And why are there parrotfish talking to me in weird ways?
Yeah, their lack of justice. I mean, they cry out for justice. And, you know, so much from my perspective, I would want to go try to make things right with them. And the fact mm-hmm. that you're left with no way to do that, you know, you have the awareness of what happened and the desire to at least say, I'm so sorry what those idiots in the past did. And I wasn't even on Earth at the time. But I think, as Fred said, oftentimes it's really offering an interesting void for a creative person to paint with their own imagination. And right. people who like Star Control, one of the things you can tell is that they're imaginative and they're readers. And mm-hmm. so I like everybody who likes our game for beyond the obvious reason. But when you do that, there's a category of people who aren't interested in filling it in. They want to have everything mm-hmm. given to them and they don't dig it as much. But it's so much more effective, like when Fred said, when you construct your own story, I couldn't do what you just described if I tried to say it all in those words. But I'm really happy it had that effect. I mean, that's so gratifying.
I mean, think about the fact that this is like 1991 to now. That's like 30 years. This race has stuck with me as just like they never got they had a planet and they were going to get free. And then these damn fish things came and it's just over. And I'm still mad about it. It's like, no, I am not a happy camper, buddy. Like, this is not okay.
I was going to say, I love this intersection of like D&D writing and stuff, which is kind of different from it's interactive writing and that's separate from novel writing. And you're giving people a chance to like poke around and find answers if they're interested, or at least like hints that they can pull together themselves. Like my favorite was like the male gnome and the male norme. Mm. And like, that's never yes. explicit, but you can put that together in your head. And it's like, oh no, these guys are like the equivalent of that dude at a party, that, like always leaves right before the cops show up. And that's why they're still around.
How does he
so
know?
When they bug out, it's like, oh, maybe shit's real now. Like, should be worried. It's there for you to piece it together. And if you want to like pull at that thread, you can get it. But you know, it's not like just given to you as exposition.
And they're certainly not going to tell you.
No, the manner, I've been working with a guy named E. Hutchinson, who's a volunteer writer. He's helping me write. And, you know, this game meant a lot to him. And he's, you know, been an editor at Ars Technica forever. He's a really good writer and good thinker. And he, when we started writing together, I hadn't given him the whole spiel about interactive narrative and how different that is from linear narrative. And not only in the manner in which you write it, but in the intention. Yeah. And so we went through that where initially, you know, he was writing this back and forth between two characters and you only had like one choice you could make because he just thought that's how you implemented a conversation. And I you know, was talking through like, let's go back through what we did in the first game and how, yes, there's like the normal dude thread, the normal person thread. You can just follow it. You're like hero protagonist 101. And then there's the like, I'm pissed off now and I want to say something nasty, or I'm bored and I want to say something nasty. And then there's the like, I'm like Greg Johnson. I'm sweetness and light. And he's the guy who did Starflight and who wrote the work. And, you know, Greg would never say anything mean. He would always try to be nice. And because I'm a cynical person, that never works. And So that the ability to essentially let you poke around, in one way of looking at it is you're poking around in a database. Another is that you're having this conversation. And I did a podcast a few months back about this, but that I had this epiphany when someone told me literally how this works is that in a game, conversation can be considered a maze. And
yes.
And each room, so to speak, has a series of doors. And the room is a subject or a topic that you're talking about. And you can be in this room for a while, but eventually a door will open up. So you're changing the subject, and now you're traversing to a new place in the conversation. And ideally, you might be trying to get to the exit. You might be trying to get to the room with a treasure, which is a piece of knowledge that you need. And just that simple description of how to structure a conversation really influenced Dark Control 2 tremendously.
It's one of my favorite D&D tricks, actually, is like when you're having a puzzle dungeon or you're having, you know, a conversation moment, and it's not combat, but it is combat because we're sparring verbally, and you create this kind of decision tree of like, okay, well, if you say these things to this person, the doors are going to shut and the enemies are going to come in. If you say this one, you're going to get the magical orb that lets you do the thingy. And it's such a fun and interesting way to structure a dialogue, because it lets you, you know, evolve the conversation based on what the players are doing, and also give them the illusion of choice. And one thing I think, like,
the illusion, that's so important.
Well, because, like, you know, you see things like later on in Mass Effect and other games that have come since, the idea of conversation.
Yeah, all the decision trees like recollapse.
Yeah. KOTOR did it especially. But like in Star Control, where all of the text has already been written and you've kind of got a linear path to follow, it still makes you feel like you're taking choices. And like, there's some of these decisions you're like, oh God, if I do this, he's going to attack me and I need to do this. And eventually, I mean, Star Control is early enough that it was still a little railroady and you still feel like where you're going. However, the tension that you guys managed to imbue in that was still there. And it still made for a very entertaining kind of way to get through. I mean, like, when you go back to that game, there are reams of text in that game.
Yes.
Like, there are books.
There's a lot.
Just dialogue. And getting people to sit there and have to hit spacebar, spacebar, spacebar to get through an entire, like, you know, novel from the Melnorme about, I don't know, the Bervixi or whatever they're talking about, is the fact that you were able to continually do that for hours is a testament to the quality of the hooks that you're putting in there.
One of my favorite moments like that was with Whiffo, where you can say, tell me about yourself. And you know, that's always dangerous to say under any circumstances. And he just goes on and on and on.
Doesn't he say, like, the best day of his life is when his mom remembered his name?
Yeah. He had a lot of brothers and sisters.
Hundreds of siblings, yeah.
Oh, well, the conversations themselves weren't just mazes, but also they interlinked with the other conversations. And so you could talk to somebody and then come back to a conversation, and there'd be a whole new set of maze rooms available.
Yeah. And of course, I love, like, the captain just losing his patience. Like, tell me what you're doing on Pluto now.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, the first time I ever played Starcon, and I was, sorry, this shouldn't be the Shivam show, I'm apologizing, but the first time I ever played Starcon, I was driving and trying to figure out how to pilot that ship, and I went to Pluto first, and I saw the big purple dot, and I saw Whiffo, and I was like, holy crap, have I stumbled on something I shouldn't? This is so sick, oh my God. So, like, I feel like I circumvented something and felt really cool, but I also love that you seeded a random planet with, like, a mega orb of crystal, like the purple crystals, and then B, an alien race. So suddenly I've got a hook and a plan and a direction to go in, which in a map where, like, when you look at the map of Starcon, it is intimidating. It's huge. There's a billion stars. I have to memorize them all because I lost the map and had to put in the, you know, the piracy protection by hand. But you have no idea where to go or what to do. So when you stumble on this dude and you're like, hey, here's my home planet, you're like, boom, got a thing. That is like Mario-esque level of training someone how to play this game, which is fascinating. And the ship sucked so much in the beginning that getting someone to actually suffer through playing that until they get a good ship implies that you were doing something correctly.
I think a lot of people may have written the word probe down in their own blood with my name underneath it.
Yes. I was going to say, as friendly as the starter is, like Shivam was explaining, those probes will never, I will never erase We Come in Peace from my mind. It will always, always be there. Why?
You come in pieces, bitch. That's what you come in.
Some alien's going to show up at Earth, and he's unfortunately going to meet a Star Control fan, and then this chance for first contact will be blown. Like, what did you say?
Von Neumann probes are just the last boss of life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I actually love how these terrible, sinister probes, you find out they come from this these really nice little marshmallow people. And they're just like, wow, how did that go for us? Oh, it went really terrible. You're really, you're driving extinctions out here. Oh, no, we don't want that.
this is something actually I wanted to ask about is that's just a classic sci-fi conceit, you know, coupled with like, you know, good intentions gone wrong. But totally like, do you have any like favorite like gold and silver age sci-fi like stories or authors? Because I can see lot of that. Like obviously Larry Niven's in there. Like I noticed that, and even in like mail order monsters, like the lion bear guy is named Sin. You know, how do you say Kazinti? Yeah, he's one of those.
It recalls you have to growl a lot when you say it. I think no, of course he's one of my favorite writers. I mean, I think Jack Vance always is at the top.
Yes,
Fred and I just sort of separately have loved him to pieces. And I reread Jack Vance frequently.
I hear that a lot from D&D people. I think adoption of would you call it a magic system? I guess you would.
Well, dude, the Vantian magic is famous for a reason, man. Like fire and forget, maybe that's
They call it Vantian magic.
Literally, it's Vantian magic because that's what it is. It's Jack Vance. We stole his stuff and it's the basis of all things.
If you haven't read any of the Dying Earth stuff, also, if you like Gene Wolfe at all, I mean, everybody takes a very different flavor. Yeah, he's kind of hard to read. But like all of that Claw, the Conciliator stuff feels like it's sort of in a really serious and unpleasant corner of you know, the Dying Earth. But anyway, it's I really recommend it a lot.
Yeah. You also mentioned early Stephen King. I'm a huge fan of early Stephen King. Any direct inspirations you can talk about?
You know, Salem's Lot to me, it was the first book I read of his. And I thought it was super effective in how it contrasted really horrible, like children are dying. Oh my God. That's maximum level. Then with like, my toy is glowing, my Frankenstein glow in the dark Aurora model is glowing when vampires are nearby. And the contrast of the trivial with the sort of cosmic horror drama, I can't say where exactly I utilized that, but to me, interleaving that stuff was really powerful. And there were a couple of things. It's funny, in some of the Lander text, you know, where, you know, report from the surface stuff.
Oh God, yeah, those are great. Yeah.
We were able to embed a little bit of horror in those. Mm-hmm, and it's for, sure. For me that I felt can't remember exactly the details, but one of those felt super effective to me. But in terms of other people, because there's so many writers I want to talk about, Dan Simmons is fantastic.
Young Orson Scott Card.
Yep. Orson Scott Card, you know, politics aside, you know, his first
Speaker for the Dead is still great. Like I can't fault
such a good book.
And he actually wrote an early review of Archon, believe it or not, which I loved because he liked it.
No idea.
It was one of the first ones.
Nice.
We played with him on game night with Greg too.
He wrote a story about game night at Greg Johnson's house. It was called Feed the Baby of Love. And it was weird story, but we were playing this game that Greg Johnson had created called Feed the Baby of Love, Many Beans, or Perish Forever in the Flames of Hell. And it was an awesome board game, which he actually later retrofitted into the Toe Jam and Earl board game. But the original was great.
What?
Yeah. Are you familiar with Toe Jam and Earl?
I'm familiar with Toe Jam.
Oh, yeah, I knew there was some crossover there, yeah.
That's not the conversation I expected from...
Well, we can get into Choo Choo Soul. Greg Johnson, man, you got to talk to that guy. He is a polymath creatively and a sweetie.
So, did you ever play Space War?
Oh, yes, I did. humorously enough, Fred, you want to talk a little bit about that?
What in particular?
Oh, just the prototype. Fred and I were at UC Berkeley at the exact same time. We didn't know each other yet, so it would be years later after Fred got his degree and I didn't. And but there were, you know, UC Berkeley was a big school, but there were like specific haunts that you tended to lurk at. One of them was called Silver Ball Gardens. And it was this classic kind of, you know, it had been a pinball place and then it transitioned to arcade stand-up video games. But there was a guy who was bringing prototypes of his game machines. And years before they would be released, so Space Wars was brought in as a prototype there.
Hmm. Wow.
It was called Space Wars as compared to Space War! Exclamation mark, which was it was based
PDP.
PDP 1. And that was, so I didn't get a chance to play that in its original form, but I played this like crazy. And I don't know, Fred, if you went in there as well, but they had
Silver Ball.
They had his follow-up games, which none of which made it to market, but he had like a 4 arcade stand-up of Maze Wars that was amazing. And the problem was people would play it for hours on a quarter. And that was also he had a game called Oops, which was it was one player was playing a syringe of spermicide and the other was playing a wave of sperm and there was an ovum in the middle of the screen. And I know, are you surprised that this didn't work? And what's funny is I'm preparing for a conversation about melee combat and why it is that we went the way we did with, you know, inertial controls for a ship. And it's
I want to talk about spermicide. We got time.
So we used to go into Silver Ball, Errol and I, and play Space Wars like crazy. And he was so good at it. He really liked the no gravity mode. Anyway, because he could think and move twice as fast as I could. But that was the physical realization of what I'd been reading about in science fiction as a kid, whether it was Heinlein or I'm trying to remember who did some of the best space combat. But you know, I read a lot of Andre Norton as a kid. Yeah.
Lensman
and all of that. And so, but I'd also been sort of trained by Star Trek growing up with that. And that was sort of the third parent. And so there was this succession of building in me, at least, a model of what I wanted to do in space combat. Mm-hmm. And then making Archon with John Freeman and Anne Westfall, we sort of defined this hierarchy of there's the thinking part, which is slow paced, and then there's the fast resolution of combat. And, you know, we had, but one, each character had only one power. And then in Mail Order Monsters, you may sense a pattern in Adept, same thing, Mail Order Monsters. Now you can build your own creatures. And then Evan and Nikki and I proposed Star Trek Archon on the phone. And I have I pitched it with an advertisement for the game, and and it became StarCon, Star Trek Archon. Evan and Nikki and I went our separate ways, and I, the producer or assistant producer I had at Electronic Arts, moved to become a full producer at Accolade, and I signed a 3-game deal, which was great to, you know, I had a wife and kids at this point, and a sort of regular money sounded really good. So then there was a 3-game deal with no programmers, just a game designer, me. And so I desperately needed a partner. And Greg Johnson, and we had some mutual friends, Errol, and as one of them. And they all said, hey, there's this really the best programmer we've ever seen at the company we work at. His name is Fred. Why don't we bring him over to game night and see? And he wants to go back to making games. And maybe we can do a blind date with you two guys. And so we met at Greg Johnson's house, and the rest is history.
Wow. That's really incredible. Actually, you mentioned something there that I kind of, you said 3-game contract deal. Now, I've been thinking a lot about Star Control on a 3DO and just why the 3DO, number one. Number two, there's got to be some crazy stories you have there. Number three, why not PlayStation? Where was the PlayStation port?
That is a crazy story. It was a total fluke that it ever came out on the 3DO. We, at the time, so we had just finished Star Control 2, and we had that 3-game deal with Accolade. And so we came back to discuss the third game, and they said, how about we do Star Control 3 with the same amount of money we gave you for 2, which... And that money ran out with 6 months to go in the game. And so you could imagine that we weren't very happy about that. And also, we kind of needed a cleansing of the palate. And anyway, so we didn't do anything with Accolade. They released us from the third game. And we hooked up with Crystal Dynamics to do the Horde. And one of the things we agreed to do with them was the hoard on the Sega CD. And so we hired a couple of friends to do the Sega CD port and convinced them to leave their safe, cushy jobs. And literally on the day before they were due to show up to work on the hoard Sega CD, the project fell through. Sega said, "No, we don't want it." So we felt bad that we'd convinced these people to quit their jobs, and they were showing up the next day. And we talked to Crystal Dynamics and said, "Hey, maybe we could port Star Control 2 to the 3DO if Accolade will let us do it for not too much money." And so that's how the 3DO port of Star Control 2 happened.
Humorously enough, the first people to pay us royalties on our own IP was us, because when we licensed our own IP from Accolade, we had to pay them and we got a very small amount of it back. So anyway, they were not the best at licensing our IP when they had access to it. But one of the nice things was there's a guy named Mark Cerny who is one of the...
I interviewed him a long time ago.
Right. He is in one sense, one of the gravity wells that the game universe whirls around. Mm-hmm. When you investigate his history and his impact, whether it's in games, in arcade stand-ups, or mascot games, like Spyro and Crash, mm-hmm. or yeah. the hardware of the new systems. Mark Cerny is at the center of all of it. And strangely enough, he was in the weird little private school in Berkeley I went to, and he used to hang out at Silver Bowl Gardens and wear cowboy boots.
Wow.
I think that's right. Maybe it was downstairs at the ASUC, which was the UC Berkeley. Anyway, so to make a long story short, he was one of the founders of Crystal Dynamics, or he was one of the first employees. And he was kind of their head programmer at the time. And thank God he was a Star Control fan. So he was, when they were like, "Is this a good idea for us to make a 3DO? He's like, "Yes." So thank you, Mark, for that. And these poor guys showed up, and I mean, we had really had to struggle to make sure that we could have a project for them. This wasn't an easy thing to just snap our fingers and have it work.
Right,
there.
Of course.
But it was a hard thing for them to tackle. And actually, I think Richard Ontaki, one of the two guys, not the programmer, but the designer artist, I think he's the voice of the Thridash. I think he did the Thridash voice.
Oh, Thridash are great.
So that's what survives. It turned out to be really important, because when the time came for Chris Nelson, who was a summer intern of ours, he really wanted to work on making an open source version of Star Control, the Urquhart Masters mm-hmm. project. I believe, was it the 3DO code that we had left?
Yeah, we didn't have the original PC code anymore.
Wow.
That's so wild.
Back then, there was no cloud to put things in, and so various physical media would break down.
A lot of game code has vanished to the ether, and it's really a bit of a shame. But I was thinking about how, just going off track for a second here, back then storage was expensive, so saving over stuff was kind of the norm. And you don't even think about game code, Final Fantasy VII, what are we ever going to do with this? So, yeah. But the 3DO, you also added a whole bunch of stuff, and that must have made things even more difficult.
Yeah, I think, Fred, do you want to take that?
I was just going to say, we did add a bunch of stuff, but I forgot to mention that although the Sega CD was canceled, we were on the hook for a Hoard 3DO version. So we were already into the 3DO. So in terms of just making Star Control 2 Urquhart Masters run on the 3DO, that wasn't a big stretch for us. But we did add, obviously, the voice is the biggest thing we added.
And we revised the menu system. That was our first. Well, that wasn't our first experience. We had made the Sega Genesis version of Star Control 1.
That's right. Yes.
And the biggest cartridge in the universe at the time. And it taught us that, there's using a directional controller was rough. And so we went into the 3DO version, which of course had a directional controller, trying to fix some of the problems. And, we mm-hmm. fixed up the menus a little bit, made them prettier. And there were a couple of other things we did. We added Crystal really wanted us to do full motion video. And, so we did that, and that drained a lot of energy from me. And then doing the, you know, I did all the recording. And so it was me, you know, finding a quiet place with either Alex Bennett, who was like the shock jock guy in the Bay Area at the time. And he did the Starbase Commander, or like
very commanding voice.
Oh yeah. He was, oh man. And the outtakes and that stuff was hysterical. He was not him trying to say Chenjesu. And I mean, we did like, the whole thing in a day. So he worked really hard.
Oh geez.
That's a lot of lines.
I've worked with voice actors in video games before, and trying to do all that in a day seems pushing it.
Oh, like, oh, I did. I had no sense of what I was doing to people. And so if you're talking like this for 4 hours straight, you know, but like, I remember Greg did the Pakunk, and I'm trying to remember who did the Arilu. I can't remember, but I had like, there were parents. So my kids went to the Waldorf schools, which is a particularly version of alternative education. And it very heavily pushes theater and performance and myth in your life, essentially. So most of the parents there, and particularly in Marin County, had some musical or artistic bent. And there were a couple of people there who either were voice actors or were just actors, professional actors with great voices. So we would be at some, you know, school function, and I would sort of hit them up to, you know, hey, seventh grade teacher, you've always wanted to be a voice actor, haven't you? So we literally got one of the teachers there, this guy, Rick Betts. He did the art.
Although his father was an actor.
Yeah. Father Knows Best. I don't know.
Father Knows Best. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a
very densely packed world of network connections. But so we didn't have much money at the time to do this. So we were hustling. And I remember I wanted to do effects on the voices. And so I went up to this just like guy's cabin in the woods with a ton of effects computers and hardware, and spending an entire day, like every time he wanted to relax, I'm like, oh no, we have another one to do. Oh no, we have another one to do. And, you know, I think, in retrospect, I dialed the impact of all of the effects up so high. Some of them are kind of hard to understand. And if I could go back in time and change that, I would probably adjust that.
The echo on the Micon is terrifying.
Oh. This is kind of a non sequitur. I lived like literally over the fence from that Waldorf school when I was in Berkeley. I just had to look. It's like, that sounds really familiar. He's like, yeah, across from Willard Park.
Yep.
Like I was in the backyard cottage that was right behind that.
There, wow. Yeah, there was one in Berkeley, and then there was one in Marin County. And there's a lot of good things about them. And Fred's kids went to a slightly
deluded.
I considered it filtered. It had some of the good stuff and less of the kind of strange stuff. But my kids loved it, by the way. I got to say, when I freaked out at one point, put the kids in more traditional education, and they have never forgiven me for that. I mean, they're like,
don't blame them.
One's turning 40 next month, and he still is mad. But both of whom appear in the voiceover, actually, at the end of the game.
Really?
With my daughter, yeah. That at the end, there's the grandfather who's talking to the children, and then there's the main character. So my voice was the main character, my dad was the grandfather, and the two kids are my kids.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's so totally like taking advantage of my position to get that in there.
Free labor.
Yeah. Yeah. Slave labor by my children. Awesome.
So Star Control 1 is a dramatically different game than Star Control 2. How did you make that jump into making much more of a story-driven, exploration-driven game than the way the first one was, which is like way more arcade kind of shootery?
Combat, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Star Control 1 was our first project together. So a lot of that time was spent getting to know how to collaborate together and just kind of building the underlying technology of the space combat. We obviously didn't use the strategy game in two, but so So that was kind of getting our feet set firmly in the ground, and Paul sort of teasing a larger story. And so from that sort of solid footing and with that story already out there a little bit, we were able to make that bigger leap.
I think also giving credit where it's due, there was Starflight, you know, and Greg Johnson was a very close friend of ours, and it had executed an adventure. Maybe it's hard for folks to go look at the screenshots of it and understand it, but it had moved me and inspired me, and I had done a tiny bit of work on it. I sort of, believe it or not, abandoned Bail Loader Monsters for a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah, you were supposed to be doing that.
I was so enraptured with what those guys at Binary Systems were doing. And I, you know, was thinking about conversation. I was working with Greg on conversation systems, and that just kept sticking in my head. So, you know, I wanted very much to take this idea of Space Wars combat and blow it out into an adventure narrative. And then, you know, kind of the Star Trek ingredients of traveling to new worlds. And, mm-hmm. you know, so there was one, Greg was right there. You know, he was literally one door down the hall because we were sharing a suite of offices. And so, you know, having him around as to bounce things off of, and, you know, he was cool with what we were doing. And then I would think, like, you know, when I was playing this game, what I really wanted to do was X. So that's what I'm going to do. So in yeah. a way, it was sort of taking this template that was so fun and then saying, okay, combat is solved, man. We're going to kick ass every time we go into combat. I'm not worried about that. Now what about the conversation? Well, I gave Greg all of this good advice. I'm going to totally do the exact opposite. And I had been playing Monkey Island, and I was cracking up at, I mean, the contrasts between what you could say. And that goes through all of our heads. Like, I could tell this person what I really think, or I could smile and say something bland. And so I just sort of said, yeah, boy, that was a good thing I told Greg, and maybe wrong. So I'll do this other thing. And I had also, in the meanwhile, worked on a text adventure project, which never came out, with Errol Otis. That would have been cool. But I had learned about this conversation as a maze thing. So there, and also there was no like design document for the game. Fred and I built it organically, just sort of one piece at a time, kind of starting from combat, working outwards.
And, which might explain why it was 6 months late, but.
And it might explain why I convinced Fred to do this whole thing about away teams, which we had to throw away completely because we got it done. And my design
away teams, yeah.
Boring. It was boring. And there's this thing that I call the Paul Ritchie lesson. So like, there's the Kazin lesson, right? Which, being a Larry Niven nerd, I will say that the efficiency of your engine is directly proportional to its use as a weapon. Right.
Love it.
So that's the Kaczynski lesson. The Ritchie lesson is never let the computer do something that the player would have fun doing. Mm-hmm. And that seems like an obvious thing. And yet, again and again, I find myself convincing people to go against that. It's like, no, what we really need to do is let the computer do all this fun stuff, and you just sit back and press a button.
I like the contrast between, like, at the time with Starflight and games like Elite and whatnot, there was kind of this discovery of what you could do with, you know, procedural generation or extrapolating from a seed, and to use some of that, but then to realize that, you know, a bespoke universe where things are placed has a much more personal feel to it.
It allows you to tell a story.
Oh, but that was one of the things you guys kind of went a little astray on in the podcast. Universe is basically 100% generated except for the location of the stars and the Earth solar system. So
really,
yeah, the where all the rest of the planets are. And the only thing that was placed was after, this is kind of a funny story too, but after the planets were generated at each of the stars, we would go in and say, okay, we want the Sirene to live here. So we have to place a vault somewhere on the planet somewhere. Mm. And we would go into the generated solar system, and I would overlay the generation with that placement. But all of the rest of it was generated.
Yeah, you let it fill in the empty spots, but then, like, the things that you need for story and events, you go in and...
Yeah.
I guess that would explain why sometimes you go to a planet and it's a vacuum and there's animals living there. So is that because of the generation?
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing was, is at one point towards the end of the project, for some reason, I can't remember exactly why I did this. Maybe I was just being mean. I changed the random generation. So the whole, all of the locations of the planets changed, which just made the testers tear their hair out.
Because that blows my mind, because the fact that it's so early, that the idea that you could have even generated that, I mean, I guess it's just a matter of like having a computer spit out a spreadsheet with randomized coordinates and then uploading it or something like that. But it just, because it feels so rich and vibrant. And yeah, I guess now it makes sense to me that you wouldn't want to go and hand populate every goddamn planet in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that would be.
But like, just make sure to say like, oh, we need to have FWIFO on Pluto, so we're going to put him there. Or, you know, we need to be in like Delta Vulpiculae for whatever reason. But there's so many stars. And when you go and you're playing the game and you're just exploring, you're like, there's no way all of these have meaning, but you don't know and you need to find out.
Yeah.
And so like, but if you waste too much time, the Korra eat the world. So don't.
Yeah, and we don't warn you about it. So sorry. We're actually
that timeline, by the way, is cruel and hidden and cruel.
Yes.
Yeah,
but if you think about games of that time, like the Sierra games, you step wrong by one pixel and you're dead.
Yeah. So, I was a Sierra game hardcore. So
you missed one object in the beginning. That was what killed me in Space Quest. I think I forgot the piece of broken glass from your escape pod in the very beginning that you need later.
Oh, so that's what you save the world with. Yeah, for sure.
Or your random stogie that's just like thrown away and you're like, I don't need that. No, you do.
I just remember walking into a room where there was walking into a region on a landscape and there was a Gorgon that just killed me instantly. And this message came up, you should be more careful. And I remember swearing.
Go to hell, buddy.
So much. Yeah. Just like, I got. Yeah. So that was rough.
Speaking of swearing uncontrollably, dude, you have the first battle be against a goddamn Ilrath who zoom in with a cloaked ship, jump right next to you and torch your stupid human ship. Come on.
It had less than
still mad.
Crew.
30 years, still mad.
Well, it was kind of damaged, like, wasn't it? Like,
yeah, it gives you a chance, but it is intimidating at first. It's kind of a jump
scare.
Yeah,
but your nukes go all over the human ship sucks so much.
That's why you get flipped
so much, and your bullets go nowhere.
Which are a launch of all my missiles in all the other directions except
yeah, like,
for
what the hell is it? Yeah,
that was. I won't say mistakes were made, but we might do things slightly differently. I mean, I think one of the things I've thought a lot about is training on inertial flight. There was no training.
But it was 1990. You've learned to play a game by playing the game. You read the manual and then you figured it out. Good luck.
And then you got a Game Genie.
It was a great manual, at least.
Dude, one of my favorite.
It was a great manual. I still have it. It's still one of my favorites. You can't see behind me, but there's a whole bunch of trash, but there's a. My Star Control 2 box is right there. I actually got the first game at a thrift store. And then I heard about the Urquan Masters. And I said, you know what? Like, I love this little 486 that I'm playing on right now, but I'd rather play on an actual computer. What had happened was actually, on a personal note, in 2003, I had kind of got sick. I got tuberculosis somehow, and I had a breakdown at my work. I was a janitor. So I couldn't do it anymore. I just kind of couldn't work for a year. So I was stuck at home. I didn't really want to leave. And that was when I started playing Star Control. Like, Urquan Masters was free, and I downloaded it. And it made such a huge impression on me. Like, when I hear the Cold Moons, I instantly go back to that summer and my gradual getting better. Like, 2004 is when I played. That's when I started to get better. But I just think it's so, so important that you guys put out Urquan Masters as a free game.
Yeah.
And not only is it a great game, it's iconic. Like, Mass Effect, everything that came after, like, owes something to you guys. And I love that you did that. And also, like, other games like Cave Story was another super important one. Nikki Yume was another super important one. So I'm glad that it's still there and there are people kind of following that example and saying, okay, here's a free game. It's really cool. I want everyone to play it. So just that's an aside and a thank you for that.
You're welcome. And we do have to shout out to Chris Nelson and his belief in open source, and that there was an endless number of people who would love to play the game if they had a shot at it, if they could just get it in Absolutely. Their hands. And it has paid back so much in terms of just people telling us that they loved it. But then also, you know, should we ever get our current game done, which we will. You know, it will be because there was this bridge, this 30-year bridge that we needed to have with, you know, the open source project. And, you know, a number of the volunteer people that we're working with actually have worked on versions of the game. So we don't have to educate them. And if anything, they have got so many opinions that they've developed over 30 years. Part of it is just finding the one opinion we can work with.
The fact that it's still playable on modern systems is like, it's a testament to the amount of work that they've put in, and also should stand as an example to all of us, like, who have been playing retro games forever, who, like, video games archivists, to look at this and say, like, it can be done. We can still save the best games of our, of all of these different generations, and still be able to play them. You just have to be willing to put in the work for it. And it's phenomenal to me. I mean, it's remained one of my favorite games, and it's a game that I can still hand to other people because it exists in a form that they can play.
Yeah.
And that's more than I can say for, like, I don't know, Kyrandia or whatever from, like, 1993. You know, it's like...
Even stuff from, like, 5 years ago. I've got games I can't play now. And that's either because they had servers that, like, don't exist.
You know, or... PlayStation 1 games. And I'm like, yeah, sorry, bud. What do you want me to do about that?
The Unholy War, for example. I don't know if you've gotten the chance to play that, but that is one of the bridging games for us, where it's essentially Super Melee with monsters. And characters have three powers, and it's more like Star Control 1 translated into a kind of monster fighting game. So again, sounds familiar, but
that sounds rad.
it was pretty neato for a PlayStation 1 game. It was pretty neato, and it was super fast. And I mean, it was the exact opposite of the other games we've done, where they take forever and are incredibly expensive to make. Well, that one went pretty quick.
One of the other questions I just wanted to bring up, because you guys have done a great job of covering all the things I wanted to talk about, which is neat.
Thank you for that.
One of my favorite bits in story that has just stuck with me over the years, the origin of the Urquan with the Korra and the Xerza and the Excruciator and the whole idea of, like, you've got a psychic monster that's controlling you. How do you do it? By just putting extreme pain to yourself. And I was like, holy crap, these guys have turned the horrifying villain of this into not only, like, a sympathetic hero, but somebody that you're, like, actively feeling bad for and also just, like, want these people to win and survive. And I'm still blown away that you've managed to turn these villains, who are obviously here to genocide your entire species and evaporate your planet, and turn them into people that you feel like you feel pity for. And you feel also just like when you read, like, oh, and they survived and they freed, and you're like, oh, you feel like they're justified, and just like, man, they lived, they survived. It's so cool. But that Excruciator bit, man, that is a hell of an origin story.
Like, thank you.
So good.
It is. It's hard to have a villain that means something and not want to make him or her or it appealing. I call it the Buffy rule, which is that every single character needs to be sexy or interesting, or you understand and you care for them, and they're twisted, but they're so close to being okay. It's very hard to have just a hollow bad guy, you know. So when the way that those of us who talk to the characters in our heads, you can't just put up a flat mask of them, because you've talked to them, you know. You know, there's and I remember having this conversation with Fred, which is, what is their reason? Why? Why do they? You know, it takes so much energy to travel between the stars. Why would you do this? And I remember there was two things running in my head. One was, gardening is weird. And because I was gardening at the time, and gardening is weird. Gardening is like, hey there, world, I know what's best. And let me in here. And then I'm going to kill you. But because you're a bad plant and you're a good plant. And the plants are like, what?
I'm just existing, dude.
So that was part of it, was this idea of crazy gardeners. But then in my family, there had been someone going through sort of realizing a lot of trauma had occurred earlier in her life, and it had really affected her. and how she behaved now. And things that seemed really confusing became clearer when you understood the trauma. And right. And it's not something that's easy to get over. There's no sort of thing you just snap your fingers and everything's okay. So for me, that was the power behind it, was like, oh, I actually have seen this. This is something that in a narrative makes sense because it's real in the real world. And, you know, whether it's PTSD from Vietnam or, you know, abuse, it's there. So it was sort of those two things mixed together. And I love how, in retrospect, when I go back now and read them, like Sarah Saw are so officious and sort of like cold, like you were saying. And then you go talk to the guys who you know are just going to kill you, and they're much more relaxed. Like,
oh, they're very chill.
Well, very they know zen. Where they live in the universe, right?
Exactly. And they don't, they have exactly zero fucks about what they're doing. It doesn't matter. And they've been through this, and it's satisfying because you get the bones. You get the bones. And
it's the nature is what it is. It's like the green ones are sitting there going like, we need to try to control everything. We need to have this material world. And they're unsatisfied. They're trying to dominate this universe because they don't know how else to do it. And the Kora have given themselves to just reality. And they're like, look, there's no good, there's no evil, there's no happiness, there's no sorrow, there's me and your destruction. That's the end of the universe. And they're just going for that nihilism. They're going for that ultimate dissolution. And in a sense, which is weird to say for the, you know, genocide, they're the ones who reached Buddha nature, and they're like, here, there's nothing left for me. I don't care what you want. I'm happy to be happy or not happy. I'm just going to kill you. And that's,
actually a line that I love where when you meet the Khazar Saw, the Kora, one of the things you can say to them is, please don't attack us. We're not your enemy. And they say, you're right. We have no enemy. You're not our enemy. You're just a spore. You're dirt. You have to just be eliminated. It's all business for them.
You say what you will about the eternal doctrine, but at least it's an ethos.
Yeah, right.
At least they have. At least they're doing
something. Stands for something. Yeah. They're not just flapping in the wind.
On the topic of the Denari, I don't know. You must know this, but do you know anything about the Hypnotoad from Futurama supposedly being ghost based on that thing?
I don't know if it is at all, but it cracks me up every time I see that meme, as old as it is. Just like, yeah, they lived on. All right. I honestly don't know. I would love to hear that connection at some point. I nothing but respect for Groening. So, not Groening, but in fact, I don't know if you've read, what is it, Life? What is his original cartoon with the bunny rabbit and the...
Life is Hell?
Life is Hell.
Yeah, Life is Hell. There's this one that sticks in my brain, and it's just, you're looking down at the bunny rabbit, and from a parent perspective at a child, and the room is just completely destroyed. And clearly the artist spent way too much time thinking through all the horrible things that had happened. And the bunny rabbit is just saying calmly, mistakes were made. You know, he's acknowledging, you know, it's all okay. He's learned his lesson, and he's willing to say mistakes were made. I've used that many times, maybe not very effectively, but you know, when things are really going to hell,
I don't know. I'm just thinking about like how when you meet the Zerza in front of the Samatra, suddenly instead of being like, we're here to kill you, they're like, human, you don't know where you're at. You really need to not be here. This is going to be bad for you. Like, I'm just...
Oh, the tone switches to pleading, basically. Yeah.
Like, suddenly they're like, look, man, it's too late. I realize that you're going to, like... I don't have time for you. Please save yourself. And I'm like, what the hell? Oh! Why at the end of the game did you give like so many Yeehat and Pekong trips to the player to fight against Samatra? Like, I mean, I love that because it's super cool. They're like my favorite trips to use, but I didn't understand why you just chose those two of like the whole fleet. And because like the strat for me was just go in with an empty ship and just win with 35 Yeehats or whatever. No,
you don't always get them. You only get them if you've done enough for the Civil War.
Well, I'm a completionist. I always get
that paid off for you then, didn't it?
Well, I mean, there's that classic sci-fi cliche of like, you know, all your friend ships show up at the end when you're your darkest hour or whatever. That plays out really well.
But that's like, where's the Spathy or the Otwig or whatever, right?
The Spathy.
The Spathy are hiding. The Otwig are being depressed.
As much as I would love the Spathy, they're not there to help. I'm just saying
the Supox deserved more.
Yeah, I think they did.
Like, they were totally ignored for the ship. I mean, I feel like the Supox...
Could you fly the Supox? Like, I have been trying to fly the Supox lately. For the life of me, Greg Hammond was an artist and a designer who was working in an adjacent space, and he did a lot of the artwork for the flagship module sections. Mm. And he could fly the Supox like nobody's business. So I was totally confident that I could someday.
Oh, no, I can't use that ship at all, man.
That's... And he was amazing with it in Melee, because we played Melee every day for years. Mm. And now I go back and play, like, what were we thinking? This is insane.
Not a fun ship.
There are some great ships like that, though. Like, they're so unintuitive. Like, I think the Druze are my favorite, just because it's easier to propel yourself with the cannon than it is to use the engines.
And all you're doing is throwing someone into the fire and burning.
Yeah.
And pay for their air. So they had to.
You mentioned in one of the things about, like, moments of horror, which you didn't see coming. I think putting in the commander getting angry at you for killing so many people.
Oh, yeah, dude.
They've been just little dots up until this point, and now someone's actually telling you they're people. And
I love that scene, like, after you sell your dudes to the Drudge and you go back to Earth, and suddenly your crew cost way more.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be on the crazy guy ship.
Who wants to be on the fodder ship? Good old SS fodder, kindling.
It's like, excuse me, Captain, do you know you sold people into death? Look, man, I really wish.
Mistakes were made.
We learned. I really wish, though, that, like, because I know when you get lost in space, you did a cool save mechanic where the Malnor may come and be like, here's some free fuel, or here, we'll trade, take your ship stuff and get you back to Earth so you can live or whatever. I wish that there had been, like, either you run to the Malnor may or the Drudge. Like, that would have been sick if suddenly out of nowhere the Drudge like,
salvage your ship.
We can save you. Just got to give us some of your friends.
Yep, that's a good point.
That would have been really, like, I mean, it would have probably been really mean, but it would have been just a cool coin flip. You know, if you're stuck in space, somebody's going to help you. You've got to.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Take the devil's bargain, man.
One question I wanted to ask quickly about the Arilu. I found them one of the most interesting characters in the whole game, because they are kind of the gray men, the stereotypical gray men, but they're not, because whereas the gray men like Fire in the Sky and other movies like that are absolutely terrifying half the time, they are almost conceited in a really charming way. And I'm wondering, like, why did you, or how did you think to make that kind of almost fey gray man? Like, what was the combination going on there?
I think... Not to trivialize it, but one of their descriptions was space elves. And I think in the first game. And so I thought that that needed to be carried through. But so I wanted them, and Greg wrote a bunch of their dialogue, and he's really into elves. So I think he carried that. But for me, there was this idea of you're important. You, personally, the player in the game, as well as the player playing the player in the game, are special. And these are weirdos. Like, they capture cattle. They probe people. They do all kinds of bizarre, kind of weird, funny, elvish, like naughty elf things. But they also have an insight into some of the most dark things in the universe. Mm-hmm. And they talk about things like they're trying to hide your smell. They don't want something to find you.
Yes.
And it puts you in this weird situation of, there's an alien race I kind of want nothing to do with because they creep me out, but they're looking out after me, you know? Mm-hmm. And part of this came from, I don't know if I've even told you this, Fred, but as a little kid, I often thought I was a changeling. Like, you look at your parents and you're like, there's just no way. And so for me, it was like, okay, maybe I'm an alien. Maybe I've been switched at some point. So there was always this sense that maybe someday this is going to be revealed, spaceship's going to show up, and I'm out of here. But so that idea that there were aliens watching out over you personally, and much of what they say sounds like a really good thing.
Yes.
Why? Are they, is this like to serve man? Am I going to get, in the end, is this going to just devour me? Or do I have a destiny that I actually don't want to have? Like, what's an alien destiny? You know, I barely understand what normal human destiny is. So that was part of it. And part of it was just that I could write anything for them, as long as it was funny or spooky or weird or kind of alluding to something that we actually would never have to pay off, but it was interesting. But it was also driven to a certain extent by this guy who worked downstairs at the office supply store. And we had given him the game to test because he had a PC and he was a gamer and wanted to test it. And he came up, and this is one of those interactions with another where what they perceive, you take that richness and you integrate it. He said, "I really liked your game," and he had some other comments. He's like, "So about the Arilu, do you believe the stuff they're saying?" And he sort of looked at us, and I said, "Nice. Oh, why do you ask?" And he said, "I have been to Roswell. I have personally interviewed the survivors, and it's all true." And I don't remember how I backed out of that, but it was just like, wow. So that was like a realization.
I mean,
like,
you do live in Marin, man. What do you want?
Yeah, we've got hot tubs and aliens. So anyway, I felt like, okay, this needs to be treated with respect. And so the whole end credit sequence where they start talking about, you know, can't remember coming in your window at night or something like that, be seeing you, I think they say, that is a direct reward for that person, as unusual as that conversation was, because they are, you know, there's this whole idea of night terrors and things that actually happen to people where you feel like someone's on your chest, you feel like you're paralyzed. And the gray aliens, at least my interpretation of what they actually are, is just a modern version of how we understand that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. It's either an incubus or a sleep paralysis demon.
Exactly. Cavemen probably thought it was like, I don't know, a big cave bear on them or something. But that's a human thing that just happens to us. And I think the way we interpret that is fascinating. But yeah, incubus is not the one I choose. But so those guys, for me, are perhaps one of the most powerful psychologically, because I both fear and desire to have that connection deep down and always have.
So that's good. I like the juxtaposition there of the surface benevolence, but with an undercurrent of something sinister. And it plays out well as comedy. It plays out well as horror. And the two they contrast great. I was going to say, it reminds me of you remember Paul Anderson wrote a story called Queen of Air and Darkness. That was like a Hugo winner back in the 70s.
Yeah. I can't remember the story. Can you tell it to me real quick?
It's basically these alien colonists. They keep coming across like fair folk that have been taking their kids and like raising them under the stars in like this fairy thing. But they're like weird mind controlling aliens or something. And it's like a long term plan to get the people off the planet.
Wow. I wish I could remember that, because that sounds right on.
That sounds really awesome. I want to read that now.
It's a good one. Like, the main character is like an XP for Sherlock Holmes. And he like even acknowledges it as like an archetype. And it's got some interesting philosophical ideas. But I always think about the Arilu when I go back to that story.
Yeah, the High Crusade is like another story by Paul Anderson started a lot of what I think another Dungeons & Dragons origin story was, that particular novel.
Oh, I can believe it.
Does the Thradish ship smile at you on purpose?
I haven't thought about that. Tell me, if I go look at the drawing,
look at the sprite of the Thradash ship, it's got the two little blue eyes at the top and then the little smiley face. It's like always been one of my favorite things, to these big stokey smoking thugs just sit there and smile cutely at you while they fart fire in your face.
I'm going to say yes. Always say yes. It's funny, my kids used to talk about the expressions on cars as we were driving down the road, and for the life of me, I couldn't see it. I felt like I had one of those aphasias of just like, I can't see the smiley faces in the back of the cars.
My mom used to say that Nissan smile. So yeah, it's there. So you've been really fantastic guests, and I'm thinking we have to kind of start winding it down, which is why I want to ask you kind of a longer question here. You guys have been around forever and a day, and you've programmed like everything under the sun, basically. And I was actually reading about the paragraph books that you guys worked on, like before even doing regular video games, before I was even conceived or thought of. And I'm thinking, now that you're working on a game now, like, and of course you did a lot for Toys for Bob as well, what's it like to just kind of make that kind of ascension in a trade like video game making? It must be like so is it difficult? Is it enlightening? Is it just, you just kind of take it by stride? Like, how what's it like for you guys?
Just like our career arc, kind of. You know, when we started working together, we just wanted to make the next game. And we kind of have always kept that mentality. But what that's meant over time is that as games have gotten more complicated with more resources, we needed more people to help us make the next game. And that led to us getting larger and large enough to be interesting for Activision to buy. And then towards the end of our Activision career, we weren't really making anymore. We were more managing people. So it was time for us to leave and start making again.
And we had also, I mean, there's always a trade-off of, you know, security and freedom between those two. And we had a lot of security with Activision. I think, you know, we did Skylanders, which was sort of objectively the most successful game of all of ours, economically anyway, and also in a certain sense, fun-wise, because we made tons and tons and tons of children really happy. Maybe we drove their parents crazy, but that's all right. But sort of felt like, okay, we've done that. We could try to do that again in the exact same circumstance. But there's also, we sort of brought a lot of people around us, and then we were just there in front of them the whole time. There was no way for people to advance into positions that they were ready to do. And I didn't. So it made a lot of sense for us to sort of move on and focus on being individually creative in this time of our lives where we still have our competences and we still, you know, we're not ready to move to Tucson yet. So it just was the right time in a whole number of ways. And however, I will say it's a real challenge to actually be, to not have a staff, to just kind of say, hey guys, let's try this, and then have 20 people hop on it. So that's a good humbling and like, remember your position in the universe is sort of objectively, you know, you need to kind of do this yourself. It is only for you and the people who enjoy it. There's no grand economic scheme that you're satisfying of a large corporation. And it is wonderful and way less stressful in a lot of ways. And then periodically you think, man, I could really use $10 million. That would really help the situation. We could solve a few problems with $10 million. And that's kind of how we thought back then. It's like, you know, we got to make like 300,000 of these toys. And if we save, you know, one paint stroke, that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so just the scale of our lives for me is exactly matching the scale of like my family. You know, I had kids in the house, I had a wife in the house. Now it's just me in the 2-bedroom condo with my collection of Skylanders and Star Control art. And so it's feels appropriate that we're back at this point where we're sort of trying to connect with something that we thought was so important and was, I think, the most beloved project in our lives. I mean, I will say for me, the Iroquois Masters and Star Control was my favorite thing I did creatively. And I had a blast doing it, and it was hard. And I've met a lot of great people through it. So I at least have been very blessed to have a career. This was plan C for me. Plan A was making fusion star drives. And plan B was being a field geologist. Turned out I'm really, really allergic to poison oak. And this is plan C. So it worked out really well for me. How about you, Fred?
In terms of plans, I graduated with a computer science degree at Cal. But while I was going to Cal, I was working at a video game company. And I made a bunch of games that were only sold over in Japan. And then I thought I was supposed to go to the Silicon Valley because that's what computer engineers did back then. And I tried that for a little while. And then I said, why did I stop making games? And that's when I decided, well, I'm going to do that again and start working with Paul. But I guess I've always been an engineer, so that there was no other plan really. But making games scratches a creative itch that sort of the Silicon Valley never did.
For sure. No, it's been it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say that you can't really anticipate, like, whenever you make anything, like, how it's going to touch people or affect them. But I do really want to just thank you for this game in particular, but, you know, all of them in general, because they were formative for me. But even Urquan Masters was, like, literally one of the first things I ever wrote about in a magazine.
That's
like,
right.
For a back page, like, free and indie games column that ended up being really good. And I did it for, like, 10 years. So I kind of, like, owe you, like, the start of my career even. If you want to look at it that way.
Thank you. We accept beer and pizza as a reward.
Or that $10 million you were talking about.
Yeah, it would be convenient.
I'll be there.
Purely
if I trip over $10 million, I'll let you know.
It's the second $10 million we'll talk about. The first, I'm sure you've got plans. Voodoo donuts for everybody.
Oh, boy.
Blue Star's better.
Okay.
Yes. Man, thank you so much, by the way. This has been like a lifelong dream come true for me in terms of just, I think you guys are right up there with like Sid Meier for me in terms of like game designers who I care about deeply. And I really appreciate you giving us this chance to kind of plumb the depths of one of the greatest games I think has ever been made. And I'm looking very, very forward to whenever StarCon 3 comes out. So, or Urquan 2 or whatever we want to call it.
If you have any good names, send them to us.
Is this Secrets of the Precursors?
The Postcursors. man.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you absolutely. Very much.
So I guess that is it for this Pekunk-loving episode of Retronauts. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much, Fred and Paul, for joining us. Why don't you go ahead and promote a thing or several things?
Sure. Well, we are, in fact, working on a direct sequel to the Urquan Masters. It'll be called not the Urquan Masters 2, but an appropriately cool name that we'll determine later. We also have a Patreon page for Pistol Shrimp, which if you're interested in seeing what we're doing, we actually live streamed our development a couple of times a week, particularly a guy named Dan Gerstein on our team does.
He has birds,
and in the future, there will probably be some sort of funding drive. You know, it might be selling candy bars. I don't know, but we'll be knocking on everybody's door when the time is right.
That sounds good to me.
And just a little bit of Pekunk trivia. The epithets they hurl in battle are my voiceover.
Oh, wow.
Jerk.
And wait, there's more. Fred was really angry at me at the time.
Yes.
And so those are all things he felt about me at that particular moment.
All in one take.
He got over it, I think.
Did you feel better after that?
I did. I feel better every time I see someone play the Pekunk.
I just die inside. But that's okay.
Well, if you think this episode is cool, we have tons more like it. Just visit Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/Retronauts. There should be enough retro content there to fill a precursor flagship. At least that's what I think. Support us at the $3 level to receive early access to weekly episodes. Support us at the $5 level to get episodes a week early, as well as 2 exclusive episodes a month. Support us at the magic number 64 for the opportunity to set the topic of a Retronauts episode once every 6 months. As of this recording, there's 1 spot left, so go ahead and snap it up. As for me, I am Naughty Oxford, co-host of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. We talk about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. Paul and Fred, it'd actually be great to get you on the show sometime. I don't know if you're JRPG fans, but gosh damn, am I ever. Are you RPG fans? Just please say yes.
I'll say yes.
Yes.
I need to look at more.
Say yes. Yeah.
I dive into games deeply once every like blue moon, and then I'm gone for 1,000 hours, and then I come back. So
that's the way to live.
We can talk. It. Fred doesn't want to hear about this, and I don't want him to know what they are, but that does happen.
Well, if you like us at Blood God Pod, you can support us at patreon.com/BloodGodPod. You can follow me on Twitter at Nadia Oxford. Until then, thanks for listening, and don't go around asking strangers to show you their glowy bits. It won't go well.